From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump has begun. After a procedural phase that saw the Senate vote to allow the trial to go forward, the team from the House of Representatives managing the prosecution proceeded to make their case that Trump incited the mob that ransacked and terrorized the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, leaving five dead, dozens injured, and a democracy shaken to its core. The presentation by the House managers included never-before-seen video that demonstrated just how close the mob came to their self-stated goal of exacting physical harm on elected officials, including former Vice President Mike Pence and current Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. While a handful of Republican senators indicated that they found the prosecution case to be persuasive, the response of most ranged from unconvinced to apathetic, and the prospects for conviction appear to be remote. The U.S. entered a precarious phase of the COVID-19 vaccination effort as providers try to ramp up the number of people getting first shots while also ensuring a growing number of others get the required second doses. Meanwhile, public health officials grappled with how to deal with new strains of the virus that may be increasingly contagious and more dangerous than the original. And House Democrats pushed past Republicans on major portions of President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package. Finally, demonstrators gathered in the streets of Myanmar's capital again Tuesday for a fourth consecutive day, defying a set of restrictions imposed by the military junta aimed at stopping the massive protests against the overthrow of the elected civilian government. Panelists, welcome. Thank you and joining us for, again, what appears to be, seems to be our annual impeachment show, talking about the second impeachment of former President Trump. The Senate began the trial with Trump accused of what Democrats and some Republicans even are calling the most grievous constitutional crime ever committed by a president. The trial has been an emotional retelling of the events leading up to and including January 6th, including a detailed timeline and a map showing the mob getting very, very close to encountering elected officials as they fled the scene of this violent mob. I'm going to start with you, Emily. The trial had to be declared constitutional before actually beginning in the Senate. What was the Republican case for not having a trial at all, given all of the evidence that we know about even before the trial started?
So the Republican case was essentially that because Trump has already left office, he cannot be impeached. Democrats pointed out that there's nothing in the Constitution that says that. And in fact, there is precedent for impeaching officials who have left office. The other irony here is that the reason that the trial started after Trump left office is that Mitch McConnell, when he was Senate Majority Leader, declined to start the trial or have the articles of impeachment at the Senate until January 19th. I saw somebody on Twitter say that their argument boils down to, if delayed by Mitch, you must acquit. And that's basically what it was, right? That the conditions have been set such that the trial had to happen after Trump left office. And therefore, they're saying, oh, well, I guess we can't do it now. Democrats overrode that argument. They voted to go ahead with the trial. And six Republicans this week joined in. But I think we should stress that it's only six. That means that most Republican senators either thought that this was convincing or just didn't want to do the trial, didn't want to have to vote one way or the other to convict or not to convict, and so pretended that it was unconstitutional.
All the major news networks and cable news networks aired an unedited 13-minute film that was prepared by House managers showing graphic and disturbing details of the attack on the Capitol. The language included obscene chants by demonstrators as they surged toward and invaded the Capitol, and there were clear threats directed at Pelosi and Pence and others. Kimberly, I was in Washington. I was on Capitol Hill at that time, and it was difficult for me to watch it again and again and see all these new things. What were the most compelling moments of the presentation for you?
I think it's important to first acknowledge just how re-traumatizing this is for folks who were there, yourself, the members of Congress themselves, the staffers. In the testimony yesterday, there were quite a few videos showing just how staff had to run and hide. But for that first opening video, I mean, you can't escape the screams of the Capitol Police officer who's trapped in a door and being crushed as the mob pushes in a very coordinated fashion, seeing people carrying a Confederate flag through the halls of the Capitol building, and this sort of awareness that you can, in some of the clips, see on the members of Congress's face as they begin their own evacuation. And I think there is a very good point that it is unlikely this is going to change the mind of many senators. But another purpose of this whole procedure is almost to set a historical record. And so I think the impeachment managers are definitely presenting this information with history in mind in terms of trying to create a narrative for how this time will be remembered, which is probably one of the reasons why Mitch McConnell has said to his Republican senatorial colleagues that this has to be a vote of conscience for each of them, because history will remember what they do.
Emily, what were the compelling moments for you in the House manager's presentation?
First, I would echo what Kimberly said. I can't imagine what it would be like to have lived through that day on Capitol Hill and then live through it again with this video presentation, and I don't want to not acknowledge that. What I will say is that it's not just about how horrible that day was, right? I think there's broad bipartisan consensus on that. What the trial is meant to do is show that Donald Trump incited an insurrection. And so for that reason, to me, a moment that really stuck out was in the opening video, watching one of the people who stormed the Capitol yell, "We're here for Donald Trump and you work for him." To me, just that clip alone kind of made the case, with the case being that Trump had incited this. The other moment that really stuck out to me from the first day was when Congressman Jimmy Raskin, who had lost his son on New Year's Eve and buried him the day before, discussed how his daughter and son-in-law were there with him at the Capitol because they wanted to be together, and how his daughter afterwards said, "I'm not coming back here. I'm not coming back to the Capitol," because he had promised them it would be safe, and it wasn't. From a legal standpoint, that doesn't matter, but from an emotional standpoint, from a human standpoint, it certainly does.
You make the point, Emily, that the point of this trial is not to declare that there's something awful that happened that day, because there are any number of prosecutions that are pointing that out of the people who stormed the Capitol. There are federal prosecutions and trials that are ongoing for this investigation of that. I think there's the key thing of trying to prove that Donald Trump incited this by his actions, not only on that day, but in the months leading up to January 6th. Kimberly, I'll go back to you. As you looked at the evidence of the things that happened before that day and the tweets that the president sent out on that day when the House managers reconstructed the timeline of things, do you think that that case is compelling? I'll pose it just like Emily did. Is it compelling to the senators, and is it compelling to the public at large?
I think that people both in the Senate and in the public are so entrenched in a predetermined outcome here that I don't know how many minds it's going to change. I mean, I think we've seen exactly one Republican senator change their mind through this process. It is a compelling argument. It's very clearly laid out by the House impeachment managers, who are the ones presenting all this evidence. There is a very clear timeline. And at one point in the testimony, I believe yesterday, you could see people in the Capitol who were in the process of destroying and hunting for members of Congress reading aloud Trump's tweets or responding in real time in the crowd, outside and in, to what President Trump was saying. It's a very clear argument. I don't know that it's going to change minds in terms of how the senators will vote, even if it changes their mind on whether or not they think he has responsibility for what happened. There are just so many political elements at play that are shaping what these senators do, because, again, they have to go back to run for election based on members of the Republican Party, regular Republican voters who are still very, very much in support of Donald Trump.
Indeed. We're going to get to that more in a minute. I want to talk a little bit about the two legal teams who are representing the different sides of the case here. We have the House managers led by Representative Jamie Raskin and the team that's led by Bruce Castor, Trump's team of Bruce Castor and David Schoen. Emily, in your opinion, or from what you are hearing, how have they fared so far in the court of public opinion, also with their audience, especially the Trump team, which would be the former president, Donald Trump?
As Kimberly said, I think the House impeachment managers have outlined as clear a case as they could outline. That doesn't mean that they're going to get Trump convicted, but they've very clearly presented the facts of the matter at hand. The Trump team has gone in a different direction. I would describe Bruce Castor's opening argument as long and rambling. He spoke at great length about how senators are extraordinary, gallant people. And I am not the only one who reportedly thinks the opening argument was long and rambling. Reportedly, the president was very upset by Castor's opening performance. David Schoen, who's the other lawyer, was sort of more direct, angry, also spoke at great length in the opening arguments. Neither one of them seemed to really have a succinct argument to present. It's also possible that that doesn't matter and that they know it doesn't matter.
Very good point. Kimberly, before we go to break, I'm going to pose the same question. Your thoughts on the two teams of attorneys, how they've performed so far. What was your feeling on how they have performed? And what do you think the Trump defense will be? Will it be a set case that does not depend on what the House managers have presented? Or will they adjust their case because of things that you're seeing now from the House managers?
Well, I mean, even members of the GOP, as Emily said, just thought that opening statement by Trump's defense attorneys was a mess. It was unfocused. And you had people like Trump supporters like Chris Christie and many members of the GOP just very confused at what they were trying to accomplish. Even some of the staunchest pro-Trump television networks cut away from it. But I think that the argument that Trump's lawyers are going to make is probably going to be very similar to the argument that we heard in the Russia investigation and impeachment as a result, that the Democrats are just out to get Trump. It's all a conspiracy. And the problem is that, as was just mentioned, they don't have to make that strong of an argument for all of the political considerations that we've laid out, unless there is a pretty seismic shift in what we're hearing from Republican senators. Trump's lawyers don't actually have to do that much. It's worth noting how hard it was for Trump to find lawyers to represent him in this case. It wasn't exactly the most sought after position in the legal world.
That's a very, very good point. It normally is a very sought after and esteemed position to represent a former president of the United States in the well of the U.S. Senate. And somehow that position was difficult to fill, as you note. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Emily, it's been noted already on the show that only six Republicans voted with the Democrats to go forward with the trial, and there would need to be 17 Republican votes in order to convict the president. Again, given the continued popularity of Trump with Republican voters and the new tolerance and even embrace of QAnon and other fringe groups by GOP legislators, is conviction even in the realm of possibility?
I mean, everything is within the realm of possibility. So I would never, after the past several years, I would never say that that couldn't possibly happen. I would be very surprised, though, if 17 Republicans decided to convict. You know, they're politicians and they're very aware of what the game here is. Now, I would note that recently, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who was the only Republican who switched his vote to say, yes, let's proceed with the trial. So he was the only one who was apparently convinced by the impeachment manager's opening argument. He recently put out a video that said to the Nebraska GOP, you can censure me, that's fine, but I did better in this state than Trump did. So it's not like there's nobody who's making the opposite political calculation, but there's one person. So it's almost nobody.
But if I can add on to that bit about political calculation, I mean, I have to imagine that there is a Republican fantasy that if they could get enough Republicans to convict Trump, that they could release his hold on the party. He has the email lists that are very valuable to politicians. He has the sway over the party. He's got his own political action committee. And so one of the other political calculus elements that has to enter this is if they do not convict him, what control he's going to continue to have over the Republican Party into the future. And is that what something that the GOP is willing to accept?
Emily, as we close out the topic, and an interesting turn of events, I think, both conservative media and the Biden White House have been spending very little time talking about the Senate trial. What has been the Biden position on the trial so far? And by the way, muted on Twitter, what is Donald Trump thinking?
I think that Biden, in fact, I know that Biden, because he said it, that his position on this is, I have a job to do. There's a pandemic. There are people out of work. There are people who need to be vaccinated, and I'm going to focus on that. I think that had there not been an attempted insurrection, that Biden would not have spent his opening days, the opening days of his administration, talking about or dealing with Trump. But Trump supporters forced this administration's hand. I think that Democrats in the House felt like they had to impeach based on what happened. And so Biden, I think, is trying to walk the line of, okay, this is happening, but also while it's happening, we're going to get my people confirmed in the Senate and into their jobs, and we're going to try to push through legislation to help people dealing with this continuing deadly pandemic. Trump, I have to say, I've seen some people who are like, oh, I wish he could just tweet just for the day. And while I do not share that wish, another difference between this and the first impeachment is that we don't have this unfiltered look into the president's mind because he's not watching TV and tweeting about it. That doesn't mean that he's not watching TV and fuming about it based on reports of his dissatisfaction with Bruce Castor. But I think both for Biden and for conservative media, the thing that they have in common is that they would both rather focus on something else.
Well said. Again, I will finish with you, Kimberly, on this one. Let me just suggest a proposition that there is an acquittal. The Senate does not vote to convict Donald Trump. And also, the House has had its opportunity to put it on record what has happened and to clearly position the role of the president in inciting the events of January 6th. Is that an outcome that could possibly bring some sort of bridge or begin some sort of unification or healing process? Or is this just bound to be another wedge in what is already a divided country?
I doubt that it's going to appeal to unity. But I also don't think it's going to have much of a difference in terms of creating an additional wedge. The wedge is already there, and the work of unifying the country is going to be a tough task regardless, because a lot of these calls for unity are asking Americans to unify with people who are avowed white supremacists or people who did raid the Capitol and try to kill members of Congress, who did try to overthrow the government. And so calls for unity are falling a bit on deaf ears on the left because they, in many cases, don't want to unify with those types of people. Calls for unity, at least on the far right, for the same reason, they want to pursue these extreme agendas. Now, for the vast majority of Americans who are in the middle, I think it's going to really depend on what we hear from the two parties. How do the Republicans try to shape the narrative in a post-Trump era? The Democrats, are they able to achieve some of the goals that they've laid out while they have very narrow control of both Congress and the White House? So this question of unity is a little bit fuzzy on the edges.
Indeed. I'd like to move on to our COVID-19 segment. The Biden administration is ramping up its efforts to bring the COVID-19 virus under control, utilizing the Defense Production Act to mobilize increased production and distribution of the vaccine. Rates of infection and hospitalization are down, but continued super spreader events and the emergence of new virus strains mean that the pandemic seems far from over. Emily, is the Biden administration fulfilling its promises to deliver a million or more vaccinations a day? And is that enough to bring it to the point where we can sort of visualize life as normal?
Vaccination production and distribution, that has increased, but is it enough? Just to be very honest, I don't know. I live in DC, and every morning we get these emails saying, okay, there are new vaccines. Oh, sorry, the vaccines have actually run out, and we just don't have enough vaccines. And I mentioned this to my family who lives in New York, and they said, oh, they say the same thing here, that there just aren't enough of them. So there are a few things here. One, we just don't have enough vaccines being distributed efficiently enough for every person in this country right now. And two, and I think I've said this on the show before, it's not just about the federal government provides for all these vaccines. It's also, okay, how are we coordinating with state and local governments to distribute them to people? We all need them, but to the elderly, to frontline workers, do teachers get them? Do restaurant workers get them? I would just bring this back to the previous discussion by saying that to the extent that there's going to be unity, I personally don't think it's going to come from any political argument. It will come if people's lives are made better. For the majority of people in this country who I think do not follow politics, maybe as closely as people tuning into issues in the news, that getting out of this pandemic and recovering the economy, that will be the thing that kind of brings us back from the edge. To be honest, it's as yet unclear whether the Biden administration will be able to do that.
Well, a big part of recovery means economic recovery, and the negotiations on the $1.9 trillion package proposed by Biden has some controversial components, like an increase in the minimum wage. There are large amounts of money for states that have been characterized as bailouts by some Republican politicians. Kimberly, the package as it stands now, the Biden administration has indicated that it has some flexibility, but not much, in what they want to do and how they want to implement that package. Where does it stand now, and when are we likely to see this legislation approved and funded? Actually going out the door?
Well, this was actually one of the reasons that the Biden administration was a little bit hesitant about how to go about impeachment proceedings, because they want to move this legislation through as quickly as possible. There's a very narrow majority for the Democrats, well, actually no majority for the Democrats in the Senate to pass this kind of legislation if it's a 50-50 split and the vice president is going to have a tie-breaking vote. And so what that means is that while the Democrats can technically move through the legislation as they want to, it's on a razor's edge. And so the Biden administration has said they are open to hear Republican options, but they will go it alone. There can be tweaks along the edges at the moment. They're sort of hammering out some of the language of it. But when is this aid going to get out the door? Too late is always the answer, because this is aid that small businesses and Americans needed a long time ago. Schools are actually pretty crucial for the reopening plan. We're supposed to hear from the Biden administration this week on their strategy for the safe reopening of schools, because this is one of the things that has really held back the economy, the additional burden on working parents, especially women who are having to manage remote schooling of children or having to manage childcare while also trying to work. We've had massive numbers of women leaving the workforce and cutting back hours just because there is no backstop for them. So this aid needs to get moving as soon as possible. They're working on it, but it's a little challenging for senators and members of the House to push through legislation while everyone's eyes are on these impeachment proceedings.
Safety, recovery, the economy, all of these things are so closely linked when it comes to this pandemic. Before we leave, I just wanted to mention a quick note about the military coup in Myanmar. The military is now back in charge and has declared a year-long state of emergency. It seized control on February 1st, following a general election in which Mrs. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party won by a landslide. The armed forces had backed the opposition, who were demanding a rerun of the vote, claiming widespread fraud. The election commission said there was no evidence to support these claims. Many officials are now under house arrest. They've been detained. I just want to ask just sort of a one-minute existential question, sort of an instinctual question of each of you, which is, in your opinion, I'll start with you, Kimberly, do you feel that the events that happened on January 6th at the Capitol have emboldened certain factions around the world to use the claim of election fraud to seek and pursue their own political ends around the world?
Yes, and I think the entire Trump administration, the 4 years of Trump, did that as well. You heard dictators all over the world echoing the language of fake news and don't trust the press, and stolen elections definitely has picked up. In many ways, the way that Trump ran the United States government did show what not only could be done and how these narratives could be manipulated, but also what the United States might tolerate and turn a blind eye to in ways that they hadn't done before. And I think this is part of the work that the Biden administration is trying to begin to do, which is reset the expectations of the role the U.S. plays in the world and what the U.S. government will and will not turn a blind eye to.
And Emily, I'll pose the same question to you. Has the U.S. been a negative influence on democracy in the world?
I would say yes, although I also think it's important to note that issues in Myanmar predated the Trump administration. I would say that looking forward, the challenge is, now that you've had 4 years of Trump, and also now that you have a military that just staged a coup that's clearly not interested in language about democracy and human rights, what do these U.S. tools do, right? Biden announced new sanctions on Myanmar and promised more measures. Okay, and if they don't listen, then what? What has American rhetoric and American threats, how powerful or powerless are those after 4 years of what we've had?
Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Thanks to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. This program is produced by The Voice of America, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.